The following is an audio podcast from the Korea Society, celebrating over 50 years of promoting greater awareness, understanding, and cooperation between the people of the United States and Korea. For more information on our programs, please visit our website at www.koreasociety.org. This podcast is brought to you through the generous financial support of the Tongyang Group. In the areas of financial services and manufacturing, the companies of the Tongyang Group harness the passion and creativity of 12,000 employees worldwide to better serve their clients. The Tongyang Group, a global partner for Korean business.
On February 25th, 2009, Henry Segerman, manager of the Korea International Investment Fund, the oldest offshore fund invested in South Korea's stock market, spoke to the Korea Society about what he sees as the perils of protectionism and the challenges Korea faces attracting foreign investment.
If you read the financial news, you have probably read the word protectionism more in the past month than in the last 10 years. Today I want to talk about protectionism in relation to the current financial crisis, and also to go over a few examples of it from the recent past. We've had a big stock market crash. It looks frighteningly like 1929. Bank lending is also frozen, as it was in 1929. Real estate prices have been falling and will probably continue to fall from here going forward. The big questions then are, is unemployment in the United States going to rise from 8% where it is now up towards 15%, 20%, or even higher, like it was in the Depression? And also, will the foreclosure rate rise from where it is now, 3%, up to 10%, 20%, or higher? A number of factors turned the 1929 crash into a depression, and protectionism was arguably the biggest factor. Economic instability often triggers a protectionist popular backlash. There's suspicion, a hunt for scapegoats, and eventually hatred of foreigners. Politicians easily play into this. Willis Hawley and Reed Smoot passed the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act in 1930, which put high tariffs on 20,000 imports into the United States and full boycotts on some of those products. They did this despite the fact that 1,028 economists wrote a letter opposing this act. And almost immediately, there was swift retaliation around the world. And as a result, world trade plunged 60%. United States industrial production fell 35%. There were widespread foreclosures and massive unemployment. I'm not really saying anything new today. It's just human nature and arithmetic. If you tell countries you don't want their stuff, they're going to tell your country they don't want your stuff. International trade is bigger and more important today than it was in 1930. And as we sink further into recession, we can see history repeating itself. We see these protectionist slogans everywhere. And also in President Obama's new stimulus package, we see Buy American provisions. Now, the Senate did soften some of these a bit, but not enough. There are still Buy American provisions against iron, steel, software, and textile imports. And the most insidious of these is anti-immigrant H-1B visas are denied to companies receiving stimulus money. Protests have come in now from Canada, Brazil, Australia, and the EU and Japan are probably going to file a World Trade Organization complaint. In a crisis like this, it's inevitable for governments to support local businesses. But what happens is that immediately causes trouble in any industry that competes on an international scale. Turning to the free trade agreement, in this kind of environment, a free trade agreement is very, very difficult. I don't think it's likely that we can see the Korea-U.S. free trade agreement happen in this kind of environment. In Korea, a matter of months ago, the Democratic Labor Party, along with the North Koreans, condemned the free trade agreement as the yoke of subordination, and they got together with the most recent ruling party that's no longer in, the Democratic Party, and interrupted the National Assembly with a two-week sit-in barricading things. So it was pretty nasty in Korea. As it relates to protectionism for Korea, we're really talking about a kind of deja vu experience. Here in Detroit, we see this bailout going on of the Detroit companies, and they just ran out of money already. They want more money. In France, they're giving money to Renault and Peugeot Citroën. Protests are coming in from Germany. It's just going to get bigger and bigger. It's a deja vu for Korea because 10 years ago, they tried to stabilize their semiconductor giant Hynix, and they too were criticized around the world by the competitors who said Hynix was getting government money. And in fact, Hynix was slapped with huge 55% tariffs during that time period. So I think that, you know, we're going to be looking, as we did in 1929 to 1933, we will look at a period of time of more conflict regarding these country-by-country bailout packages and subsidies, especially for those industrial sectors that are subject to a lot of international competition. It's ironic that the free trade agreement in Korea was criticized as created so much controversy. In fact, one of the negotiators for Korea called it a low-level deal. That's because 19 areas in the deal were excluded in the United States, and 88 areas were excluded in Korea. One of those areas was beef. During the free trade negotiations, U.S. beef was in the process of being certified by Korean health authorities, so it was left out of the free trade agreement. Former President Nomu-hyun, in fact, said that he was going to permit the sale of U.S. beef. So what current President M.B. Lee in Korea said was simply implementing something that was already well in the works in Korea. And this leads me to talk about the tragic deaths of two women last year. First, Aretha Vinson. In April of 2008, Aretha Vinson died in Portsmouth, Virginia, of a brain ailment. The Center for Disease Control cleared it and said that it was not mad cow disease. Despite this fact, the Munghwa Broadcasting System in Korea said that it was mad cow disease. And the results, as you know, a massive protest across Korea, hundreds of thousands of people in the streets, sympathy strikes at major companies in Korea, harming the economy. It nearly brought down the Korean government, it could be said. President M.B. Lee's approval rating plunged dramatically from 48.7% at the election down to 17.1%. It could be the fastest drop in presidential popularity in the history of the world, including George Bush. As a result, he had to sack two cabinet ministers, the Minister of Agriculture, Chung Woon Chan, and the Minister of Health, Kim Sung Yee. These guys lost their jobs. Now, during this whole process, the Korean government was trying to figure out what exactly happened with the inception of these protests. And they figured it out, and they asked Munghwa to apologize for the false report on mad cow disease in the United States. The first response of Munghwa was to blame the translator, badly translated, but the translator stood up and said, that's not true. It was not a bad translation. It was all editorial. And so finally, the Munghwa Broadcasting System had to come around and say, we're sorry, the whole thing was false. And that brings me to the second tragic death of a woman last year, Park Wong-ja. In July of last year, Park Wong-ja was shot in the back by a North Korean soldier. Not a single candle was lit for her benefit. I bring this up. I simply want to encourage you to draw your own conclusions about the moral perspective of the protesters protesting beef in Korea. The intensity of the protests was a mystery to me, really. And whenever I see a mystery, I like to follow the money. If you remember that line from the Watergate movie, who benefits? I did a little research, and I found out that beef, which, as I mentioned, was excluded from the free trade agreement, on average, beef costs $4 wholesale per kilo around the world, end of 2007 figures, while in Korea it costs $20 per kilo. Also, rice was excluded from the free trade agreement. On average, rice costs $1 per kilo around the world, while in Korea it costs $4 per kilo, due to stringent restrictions on rice imports in Korea. The Korean media kept a steady, most of the Korean media kept a steady drumbeat of fear during the beef crisis, you're going to die of mad cow disease and so forth. But at the same time, they were collecting significant advertising revenues from Korea's agricultural industry. Again, I encourage you to draw your own conclusions about any link between the two. However, I'll point out that elsewhere in the world, agricultural subsidies in the U.S., in Europe, in Japan, are fairly large. In fact, 40% of the European Union budget goes to agricultural subsidies. Almost 20 crops in the United States, now up to over $10 billion a year. These are 2006 numbers. Yes, tobacco growers are subsidized in this country to kill people with lung cancer. All of this, all of these agricultural subsidies here are sold to Congress and sold to the public with misty-eyed hype about how we're supporting our national heritage, supporting our small farmers. But the sad reality is nearly all of it goes to big farm corporations. In Korea, 2 years ago, $100 million of rice subsidies was discovered being embezzled by tens of thousands of fraudulent applicants, including numerous public servants. So in my view, graft and cash bag lobbying is a standard operating procedure for the agricultural subsidies and supports around the world. These subsidies have a terrible side effect that people don't talk about enough: overproduction of unprofitable crops. Those warm weather developing countries in Southeast Asia and Africa are the ones that are hurt the most. The only way these countries could enjoy some kind of economic growth frequently is through developing their agriculture industries. That's why this problem is why the 2006 Doha round collapsed in disagreement. And it's also why when the U.S. boosted sugar subsidies 2 years, 3 years ago, the World Trade Organization condemned the United States and encouraged Brazil to retaliate against us with punitive tariffs on other products. So getting back to Korea, this applies around the world. High Korean food prices mean Korean consumers have less money to educate their children, improve their lives, and just have a little fun. That's bad for the economy. This is made worse by many protected tech goods, PCs, cell phones, etc., that sell for a lot more money in Korea, sometimes 25, 50% more than they do in export markets. Again, harmful to the economy. I'm not saying anything new here. It's just human nature and arithmetic. If a country makes its people pay a lot of money for staples like rice, they will have less money to spend on the economy. Consumers everywhere prefer to save money. In North America and Western Europe, you've got Walmart, Carrefour hypermarkets, Costco, and now on the internet, Priceline.com. People are looking for the best possible deals, and these outlets are always trying to reduce costs and find the best priced products from the most efficient factories and distributors around the world. In the United States, this would not be possible in any way without the help of America's 20 million strong undocumented foreign workforce and their families, many of whom are recruited from Central and South America to work in manufacturing and service nationwide. That brings me to another tragic death last year. Ecuadorian immigrant Marcelo Lucero was murdered 2 months ago, three months ago, by a band of teenage thugs. Here they are. They're going on trial for a hate crime. They're going to spend the most of the rest of their lives in hard prisons. How could this happen? Where were their dads? Where were their moms? Maybe their moms were attending another anti-immigrant rally like this one in Hazleton, Pennsylvania. For years, local politicians have been ranting, "Mexicans stole our jobs." One of these politicians, Steve Levy, a Long Island county executive, with extremist rhetoric, was successful in passing local legislation which essentially launched an anti-immigrant militia, patently and obviously unconstitutional. For 5 years running, America's most popular news channel, CNN, in the highest-rated time slot, has been broadcasting the Broken Borders series with Lou Dobbs. And here's a clip I will show you. In addition to Lou Dobbs on CNN, you've got Bill O'Reilly on the Fox News, and you have former Colorado Congressman Tom Tancredo, the notorious Sheriff Joe Arpaio of Maricopa County, and other self-appointed vigilantes. They've created an atmosphere of suspicion. They're accusing illegal aliens of stealing votes, of obtaining services illegally, committing crimes, and even helping terrorists. In this kind of atmosphere, Congress recently passed the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Program, ICE, which was sold based on the idea of rounding up a lot of criminals and terrorists. But that turned out to be untrue almost immediately. The ICE program has spent most of their time rounding up housemaids, gardeners, guys packing paper boxes in distribution centers. They've started raiding factories, and the deportations right now in the United States are much more aggressive than they have been in many, many years, according to the Pew Research Center. So a lot of you are Koreans. You're thinking, well, that's about Hispanics. It doesn't apply to me. Well, you're wrong on that. Pat Buchanan, three-time candidate for president of the United States, in fact, winner of the 1996 New Hampshire Republican primary, bitterly faulted our 1965 Immigration Act, which allowed 864,000 Koreans into the United States. He said that it permitted Cho Seung-hui, the Virginia Tech mass killer, into this country. So for all Americans who are worried about anti-Americanism in Korea, Koreans might also think about anti-Koreanism that's being promoted by one of our key opposition party leaders. In the United States, anti-immigration hysteria is a cyclical thing. We had the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, the Anarchist Exclusion Act of 1919, the World War II internment of Japanese in concentration camps. Many of these people over the years were recruited to work here. All of this continues with Central and South Americans like Marcelo Lucero today. Maybe we need to rewrite that inscription on the side of the Statue of Liberty, "Give me your huddled masses, give me your whites-only huddled masses." Again, I encourage you to draw your own conclusion whether there's any connection between the messages coming from political and media figures like Steve Levy and Lou Dobbs and the murder of Marcelo Lucero. So in a climate increasingly hostile to foreigners, what will Obama do on free trade and the Korea-U.S. free trade agreement? He's been very busy with the financial crisis, obviously. I didn't hear too many clues on television last night. So what I like to do is look at various campaign statements that he made for clues as to what he's going to do. On one hand, publicly, during the campaign, Obama criticized companies for shipping jobs overseas. He mentioned that last night. He spoke of renegotiating NAFTA, which set off the alarm bells in Canada and Mexico right away. His campaign passed out "Buy American, Vote Obama" buttons. As for South Korea specifically, in the final debate with John McCain on October 15th, this is what he said. "When it comes to South Korea, we've got a trade agreement up right now. They are sending hundreds of thousands of South Korean cars into the United States. That's all good, but we can only get 4,000 to 5,000 into South Korea. That is not free trade. We've got to have a president who is going to be advocating on behalf of American businesses and American workers. No Democrat can be elected president of the United States without the support of the United Auto Workers. The United Auto Workers and Detroit executives
seemed to be having a delusion of 100,000 Ford Mustangs tooling around the highways and byways of South Korea. Well, it's not going to happen, ever. American cars don't last. Plus, they've got dreadful mileage, 24 miles per gallon for American cars compared to the world average of 30 miles per gallon. Now, on top of that, you've got fear of Detroit bankruptcy, a huge drop in sales. Even without tariffs, I don't think you could sell more than 10,000 cars, American cars, per year in South Korea. Anyway, when a Korean buys a foreign car, they want to buy a Mercedes or a BMW. They want to buy a foreign car to impress their friends. That's how I look at it. I'm not saying anything new here. It's just human nature and arithmetic. If you make poorly priced, inferior cars, people just won't buy them, especially not in South Korea. All that being said, let's look for clues in things Obama said privately during the campaign, the famous bitter speech. Here it is. In the Midwest, the jobs have been gone now for 25 years, and it's not surprising then they get bitter. They cling to anti-immigrant or anti-trade sentiment as a way to explain their frustrations. So maybe there is some chance Obama will come around on the Korea-U.S. free trade agreement and other free trade matters. Maybe he told a bunch of lies in his campaign, we hope, but I wouldn't count on it. Obama's stimulus, as I mentioned earlier, will deny H-1B visas to companies receiving stimulus money if they want to give them to foreign workers. And if we assume the ICE program will continue its aggressive deportations, my prediction is the result of that will be that those companies whose factories have been raided and lost all their workers, eventually they're just going to relocate the factories back to Mexico. Maybe they'll relocate them to China. I'm not saying anything new here. It's just human nature and arithmetic. These companies won't incur losses manufacturing goods that can't be stocked on Walmart shelves because they cost too much money. The result is those U.S. supervisors at those factories will lose their jobs. It will be harmful to the economy. So let's talk about Korea M&A. The Korea M&A players, they think just like the managers at Walmart. They are in it to make money. They are not in it to lose money. A few years ago, a Korean company, LG Securities, bought Petrobank in Poland. And then subsequent to that, they sold it for a nice 50% profit. Well done. SsangYong Cement also bought an American company, Riverside Cement. They sold it for a nice 250% profit. Well done, SsangYong Cement. Now, you can also apply this to the private equity business in Korea. A Korean company, MBK Partners, bought Hanmi Capital, and after 13 months, they sold off Hanmi Capital for a 223% profit. Very nicely done, MBK Partners. All of these companies did everything in their power to keep the purchase price down, way down, and to keep the sale price up, way up. I'm not saying anything new here. It's just human nature and arithmetic. Businesses are not in business to lose money. Now, the Korean government speaks of a level playing field for foreign businesses. So I thought on that note, we might talk about the Lone Star case. Lone Star came into Korea when it needed a Lone Star the most, 1998. It was one of the first customers of Korea's bad bank, Camco, buying distressed assets. When we got around to 2003, you had Korea Exchange Bank that the government was trying to sell. Korea Exchange Bank had been really hurt by debts from Hynix, which I mentioned earlier. And then in 2002, they were hurt by the Korean credit card crisis that you may have heard about. So the government was promoting a sell-off, not just of Korea Exchange Bank, other banks as well. The government sold Korea First Bank to Standard Chartered and Koram Bank to Citibank. However, with Korea Exchange Bank, it was rejected because it was perceived of as too weak. Citigroup, HSBC, Standard Chartered, JP Morgan, Credit Suisse, they all rejected it. Lone Star then came in to the rescue. They're not a strategic partner. They're a private equity player. They're not a bank. They always meant to flip the deal, just like LG Securities had flipped Petrobank in Poland. And Lone Star was very, very successful with Korea Exchange Bank. They turned around its business from a 214 billion won loss in 2003 to a very nice 1.6 trillion won gain in 2005. So, after 3 years, it's no surprise that Lone Star wanted to sell off Korea Exchange Bank. After all, in their contract, it said they could do so after a two-year waiting period. It was contemplated in their purchase contract, approved by the government. So along came Kumin Bank, which wanted to buy Lone Star's controlling interest for a very strong profit in the order of 300 or 400%. Suddenly, there was an outcry from the Financial Workers Union inside Korea Exchange Bank. They accused Lone Star of being Myok Twi, the thief who runs away, who eats your food and runs away. Suddenly, the Bureau of Audit Inspection was looking at this. They got together with the National Assembly, the National Tax Service. They asked the Supreme Prosecutor to look in on it. And then, over a nine-month period, the Supreme Prosecutor conducted 91 office raids and even some private home raids in Korea. They even raided Citigroup, who had consulted in the original transaction between Lone Star and Korea Exchange Bank. The prosecutor attempted to extradite key lieutenants Ella Short and Michael Thompson of Lone Star, but no court in the United States even looked at it, I don't think. Then the Central District Court came down with their stock price manipulation indictment, and at this point, due to the dispute, the Kumin deal died. And as we got to the end of 2006, the prosecutors finally presented their case in the Korean District Court. Getting into 2007, a second offer for the Korea Exchange Bank stake came in from HSBC, again, a very profitable deal for Lone Star. To try to clean up the mess, John Graykin, the chairman of Lone Star, came to South Korea. He was subjected to 10 days of questioning by the Supreme Prosecutor. Of course, he said that Lone Star was innocent of doing anything. Nevertheless, the district court found Lone Star and Korean Exchange Bank executives guilty of two counts of stock price manipulation. It was immediately appealed by Lone Star. When the appeal was underway and was starting to look hopeful, Korea's Fair Trade Commission stepped in. They okayed the deal, but they said, well, okay, fine, but now the Financial Supervisory Service has to look at the deal or it won't happen if the appeals court overturns it. The Financial Supervisory Service said, we agree with that. We're not going to do anything until the appeals court overturns the verdict. Finally, the financial crisis set in, and the appeals court came along and said, the appeals court overthrew the verdict and said that Lone Star and the Korean Exchange Bank executives in question were innocent of all charges. And meanwhile, the whole situation was confusing. The Financial Supervisory Service said that they were okay with the deal, but they still had to look at the final documentation with HSBC, meaning they kept holding their deck of cards and not giving the final approval. At this point, the financial crisis had set in, and HSBC terminated the deal. So you can see that with all of these government agencies, the deal between for Lone Star to sell its controlling interest in Korea Exchange Bank was strangled by regulators. This is not what happened in Poland when LG Securities cashed out profitably on its Petrobank deal. There were no raids, no indictments, and they were not branded as Polish Myok Twi. Again, I encourage you to draw your own conclusions as to whether a double standard exists in Korea regarding foreign investment, and whether what happened in the Lone Star case might possibly be a disincentive to foreign investment. However, I will point out to you two relevant data points. There was a steady fall in foreign direct investment from outside Korea into Korea from about $13 billion per annum down to about $10 billion. All this time, foreign direct investment into China was rising from $60 billion up to $75 billion. At the same time, There was a similar plunge in foreign stock market ownership in Korea from the 42% level down to 29% level. Both these situations obviously harmful to the economy. I'm not saying anything new here. Again, it's human nature and arithmetic. If a country tells foreign companies they can't earn a profit there, the foreign companies are going to go to another country. Lone Star is just one example of how Korean government officials' actions sometimes appear unfriendly to foreigners. There are others: taxation, red tape getting permits, etc., etc. Likewise, the beef protest is just one example of how public sentiment in Korea sometimes may appear to be unfriendly to foreigners. The military accident a few years ago being another example. Protectionism is a multi-layered problem. Obviously, there are no easy solutions. But let's take it step by step. First, the current financial crisis. 2 weeks ago, The Economist set forth three principles that I thought were worthy of sharing with you. First, coordination. Countries can enact stimulus programs, but only in coordination with each other. Second, forbearance. Stimulus plans should embrace open markets, even if it means that foreigners derive some benefits from them. Third, multilateralism. The IMF, development banks, the World Trade Organization, Doha, and the G20 should always be working together on creating a solution. As the world's economy improves in the coming years, we can and should deal with the larger issues here. The anti-trade voices in Korea and the United States will eventually quiet down enough for the free trade agreement to finally get ratified in both countries. In this century, as we move towards a more globalized world, free trade agreements really are just a small step, an acknowledgement of reality only. Korea, the United States, and many other developed countries also owe it to the developing world to get rid of their corrupt and corrosive agricultural import barriers and subsidies. This is way overdue. Both Bush and Obama promised to do this. Obama needs to back up words he gave last night with deeds. Anti-foreign popular sentiment is obviously a more entrenched problem for us to address today. In the United States, it is nonsensical to think we can deport 20 million Central and South American undocumented workers. It would cause a massive dislocation and harm to the economy. We should just welcome these people as citizens here, somehow. This is what we did with the Chinese, the Sicilians, and the Japanese in years past, and with all the other huddled masses. Also, we should make Spanish a required language in public schools, at least regionally, as with the Canadian model. It's about time for that. If we elected a black president in this country, why can't we welcome those 20 million Central and South Americans working here? It's not that hard. As for Korea, the Japanese occupation of Korea was a horrific situation, but Korea cannot afford to keep framing every issue in terms of its bad experience with the Japanese. It's time to put an end to the hermit kingdom mentality in Korea. Really, it's not that hard. Koreans embrace huge reforms. They embraced democratic reforms after the Gwangju massacre. Koreans embraced financial reforms after the horrific 1997 currency crisis. The Korean people turned in their gold rings in 1998. That's how much they embrace reform. Korea can re-educate themselves to feel and express more welcome and more trust towards foreigners. And I mean that not just in ministerial PowerPoint presentations, but in day-to-day reality. On that hopeful note, I would like to thank you very much for listening to my observations and recommendations today. I'd be happy to take any questions. The Korea Society is recording this, so wait for the microphone before saying anything. Identify yourself and your affiliation, and I don't mind if you make a statement or a rebuttal or ask a question, and I don't mind if you talk at length as long as you're on, on subject.
Are you
anything to add?
To steal my job?
Yes, absolutely.
Hello? Yeah. My name is Cambria. I'm retired. I'd like to revisit for a moment the Korea Exchange Bank. In 1998, when Lone Star went in, they took advantage of an instrument that was put together on a Malaysian island, which allowed Lone Star, when it did sell the bank, not to pay any taxes. So part of the reason, perhaps, that the Korean government went after the bank in such a fashion was to delay any popular protest against itself while pointing to a bank that was making so many hundreds of millions of dollars or perhaps more without paying a single tax on the deal. And that, from what I understand, was the beginning of the whole protest. Now, you didn't mention this convention that was formulated in an island in Malaysia, which did not have anything to do with Korea. It was a way of circumventing certain tax laws in order to attract foreign capital. I'd just like to say another thing. French is also in Canada an equal language with English. It is not, it may appear regional, but it's Canada is a bilingual country.
Lone Star's subsidiary, which purchased the Korea Exchange Bank stake, is domiciled in Belgium, not in Labuan, Malaysia. And Belgium
performed the sale.
Korea has negotiated many double taxation treaties with countries around the world in order to allow companies to operate. Korean companies use double taxation treaties by domiciling their subsidiaries in various countries around the world, including Labuan, Malaysia. And American companies, British companies, do business with Korea using these territories which have double taxation treaties. So Korea has no choice but to honor the treaties. It is not an illegal thing. It's perfectly legitimate. Now, that being said, I should point out that Lone Star was successful in selling off some real estate and I think some small company stakes from that it also owned. I could get you the details. But in that particular instance, they used their Belgian subsidiary as well. And as I understand it, they did fork over the tax money for those deals. So while I insist that Korea honor all of its double taxation treaties, including Belgium, you should know that Lone Star was willing to pay taxes on those sales that were permitted, real estate and small company stakes. So it's conceivable that there would be some kind of, had the deal gone through, it's conceivable there would have been some kind of negotiated tax settlement so that the clamor for tax revenue on the Korea Exchange Bank stake sale would have gone through. We're just speculating here, but they didn't have, one thing I should repeat, they did not have a Labuan, Malaysia subsidiary.
Good afternoon. Thank you. My name is Jonathan Ostroff from Morrow & Company. Recently, Korea's created DART, which is the receptacle, the depository for all publicly filed information. And they also have poison pills as coming up on the docket in Congress shortly. They're kind of creating contradictory statements, which I do feel is more reflective of the corporate Korea's perspective on foreign investment.
Neither the United States or Korea, or especially Western Europe, has a corporate structure system in place which reflects free market principles. There are poison pills in the United States, poison pills in Western Europe, especially in Western Europe. And Korea is actually late in the game conceiving of these poison pill procedures that companies can use to ward off any kind of outside takeover, Koreans or foreigners. And I would say that it's a fact that there has never been, other than, you know, disgruntled family members, there's never been a true takeover, a hostile takeover of any Korean company that I know of. If anyone here can cite one, I'd be curious. It's never happened. So the culture in Korea with the locals is not to tolerate any kind of hostile takeover. And these poison pills are simply Koreans getting up to speed with Western Europe and the United States. Same thing applies to disclosure regulations. We have in place 12D and 12G filings in this country, which require you, when you go from 4% to 5%, to disclose whether your intentions are portfolio investment or activist shareholder. When the Koreans imposed a system similar to this, everybody went crazy and said it was, you know, anti-foreign shareholder. In actual fact, and in Korea's defense, it was not. It was a perfectly reasonable paralleling of the Korean system to what exists in the United States.
Hi, Kim, Cornell University Medical College. Thank you for a nice presentation. I'd like to ask you what's your opinion that South Korea should do to enhance the chance of the trade agreement to pass? What their role, what kind of lobby the Korea should do to United States government and Congress?
Do you mean for Korea to ratify or for the United States to ratify?
Both. That's what Korean government should do with the United States and what United States should do with the Korean government. For instance, automobile issue. Let's say they sell more probably Korean-made automobile here. However, tens of hundreds of thousands of students come here. The very few American students go to Korean university. They spend hundreds of millions of dollars to education here. So exchange of this kind of, you know, singling out an item, I think give a wrong impression. I think government should really work on each other. How to really understand the reality of the whole situation so that free trade could go ahead rather than try to politically block it. And in Korea, instance, North Korean sympathizers demonstrating and blocking the South Korean government policy. So that's their problem, Korean government's problem. They not effectively stopping them, but you know, this kind of thing has to be conveyed to American lawmakers.
Okay, well, let me answer your issue there. In terms of Korea ratifying the free trade agreement, I find it truly bizarre that the Koreans in the Democratic Party, which is essentially the remnants of the Uri Party, are taking a stand right now opposed to the ratification of the free trade agreement. It seems completely crazy. Months ago, they were in favor of it. Why would they be against it? It hasn't changed at all. So all of this strange behavior with the riot in the National Assembly and the barricades and everything that's been going on, I find it really odd. I think that eventually tempers will cool off like they frequently do in the National Assembly, and they will ratify it. Yesterday, there was a meeting of a subcommittee which passed the motion to ratify. So, again, the ratification in Korea is moving up the chain of command in the Assembly, and that could be a very good sign. Now, on the U.S. side, I'm going to make a very, very strange and hard-to-digest recommendation. I think that Korea should immediately offer to reduce tariffs on American cars to zero. You know why? They won't sell anyway. That kind of throwing meat to Detroit, I think, could get the Korea-American Free Trade Agreement passed. Now, both the Nomu-Hyun administration and the MB Lee administration, through their ministers, have asserted frequently that they will not renegotiate the free trade agreement. It's understandable they would do that. They don't want a wiggle, and they don't want any revisions by the United States pushing them around. It, you know, it looks bad. But I still think that's the best way to solve this, is for them to just remove all tariffs on American cars going into Korea. They're not going to sell. It's not going to hurt Hyundai. In fact, I want to say something about cars. Hyundai's new ad campaign here is fabulous. I think they're going to steal huge market share from Detroit. If any of you have seen Hyundai's, have been watching television lately, just keep an eye out for those Hyundai ad, the Hyundai ad campaign. It's brilliant. They've been really great in coming up with these various guarantees. That's their sales gimmick, which is a good one. They had the 10-year powertrain warranty, which started about 5 years ago. And then just last week they started this, if you get fired, you can give us your car back guarantee, which is, those guys are really smart.
Dorothy Hong, as you recall, Taiwan was also a colony of Japan, and striking differences that Taiwan does not have residual deep animosity against Japan as the Koreans have thus displayed. And I'm just wondering, what do you make of Taiwanese opposing chorus in light of the fact that in recent years their views have mimicked and echoed Japanese?
Taiwan, Korea, and Japan export tens of billions of dollars of electronics to the United States and also to Western Europe. And they're competing head-to-head in so many different fields. I don't think a free trade agreement between Korea and the United States is going to help out Samsung Electronics and LG Electronics that much that it would hurt Taiwan. But maybe there's a perception problem. Maybe the Taiwanese are threatened by it somehow. I'm just speculating here. I don't follow Taiwanese politics very closely. Korea may have suffered. I'm not sure when the Japanese occupation of Taiwan began. When did it begin? Yeah. So it's as long or longer than Korea. I cannot itemize the abuses and mistreatment of the Taiwanese the way I could of the Koreans. So I don't know why there's greater animosity. And I haven't been to Taiwan, so I can't really address that. Interesting question, though. Thank you.
Leslie Norton. Henry, could you just give us your market view? Tell us where the KOSPI is going to be at the end of the year. And tell us your view in the Korean won. Thanks.
In a crisis like this, nothing rises except for correlation. So it's impossible to answer that question without throwing out a view on the U.S. market. And until the day before yesterday, I thought that, and I insisted with my clients, that November 20th of last year was the bottom of the U.S. market, and it wasn't. So we may very well be, this past week or so, in a U.S. market testing. I think until we know that there's some bottom point for the financial crisis and economic problems, asset allocators are going to be risk averse, and they'll keep their money out of Korea. But if this week was the bottom, then I think the U.S. market definitely has a potential of rising 20% this year, and the Korean market, in local currency terms, 30%. Once the asset allocators become less risk averse, I think they're going to pile into Korea heavily, as well as markets like Russia and Brazil, because the beta play is that much greater. These are leveraged markets. An asset allocator knows that an investment in Korea, Russia, or Brazil is going to fly if the U.S. market is just, you know, going up cautiously. When that happens, the yuan, which is insanely undervalued right now at 1,500, there's no reason that Korea's economy would permit that kind of low currency valuation. I think the sweet spot for the yuan is really 1,100. And, you know, if we're back in a market rebound situation, the yuan should definitely move to, you know, the 1,200, 1,300 range this year and back to the 1,100 level within a couple of years. And I should add, if all of the reforms I spoke of today are implemented, the Korean market will go up an additional 10% every year for the next 5 years.
The opinions expressed in the preceding program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Korea Society, its staff, or management. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Korea Society. If you enjoyed it, please consider becoming a member. Visit www.koreasociety.org for more information about memberships and to learn more about the programs available at the Korea Society.